his conversion at Philippi. And just by way of introduction, I think I was kind of feeling around for a title, and I put outsiders to insiders as the title, and I put it on the news sheet there. I've been thinking a bit more about that, really. It's because what we're witnessing in this passage here, as Lydia is converted, is we're seeing a church being planted, a brand new church starting. It's always fascinating to see how something starts, isn't it? The foundations it's built upon. And there's a lot we can learn from seeing how this church starts. Generally speaking, there's quite a lot of excitement these days about church planting. People are talking about planting churches again for the first time for quite a while. All sorts of churches are realizing there's opportunities rather than just building bigger buildings and getting bigger congregations. Maybe we should be planting churches in areas where the gospel's... Local congregations, reasonable-sized groups where people can get to know each other, and there's, you know, fellowship and accountability and all those sort of things. It's useful, it's helpful, rather than just mega churches. Maybe there's a good time for meeting in large groups, but real congregational life, churches... And planting churches. The FIC is talking about planting churches. So in a way, as we're going to be reading at this passage here, as we see a church being planted, I think we need to have our eyes and ears open to see what lessons we can learn. Not just for ourselves in the prospect of one day, who knows, we plant a church. That's another matter. But just that if this is God's work in building his house, there must be principles at work there that we can benefit from and learn from. And as I was looking at this, I think there are some really important benefits. This church that's been planted in this passage we're reading is the church of Philippi. You've seen the book of Philippians in your Bibles? Everybody, I would say, would probably reckon that the letter to the Philippians is one of the most encouraging New Testament letters. This church in Philippi was such a blessing. They were so encouraging. They were so supportive. They were so gospel-centered. They were so committed, generous, dedicated people. This is where it begins. We're going to see, you know, I always think it's remarkable when you see a little baby and then you find out in your biology lessons, where did that baby come from? The humble beginnings that created this beautiful being that's come into the world. In Philippi was a beautiful church. And we get to see as we read through this passage here how this beautiful church actually came into being. Now, we may not be planting a church anytime in the immediate future, okay? But I suspect each one of you wants to make good use of the time and the opportunities that you have. We are all dedicated to perform some degree of Christian service in this world. And if we're going to do it, there are things we can learn from the planting of this church. I've got five things here from the planting of this church that I think are useful to all of us to think about, the things that we get involved in, that we get committed to, that we give our time and our energy to, that we can use as a checklist to make sure that we're giving ourselves to probably the things that would be most fruitful, most beneficial, most helpful to us, that we might see the kind of fruits that they saw as they saw that church planted in Philippi. We want to see good fruit, don't we? And here are the basic five, and I'll explain as I go on. But the first is really we need good foundations. Good foundations. That is just a prerequisite for what we do in gospel work. And I'll talk a bit more about that. And then we really need a good situation as well for those foundations to be built on. We want to be strategic. Be part of the wider strategy. And then also that we need good reason for doing what we're doing. You know, we have to think about why are we doing this? Is this really part of a big plan? Are the foundations good and strong? I'll go through these in more detail. And if we're starting it, are we getting good feedback? Are we getting a good response? Is anything happening? Is it fruitful? Is it productive at all? And can this thing that we're involved with grow? And I think that's so important. That gospel work, God's work, has this factor to it that it grows. Everything the Lord does seems to just grow. So these are just indicators. So I'll go through them in a little bit more detail for the kind of things we should be looking for in the stuff that we get involved with. So the first of this is this whole issue of foundations. I'll deal with it very, very quickly. in chapter 15 and verse 40, this church, the church in Philippi, how did it actually begin? It began with in a church. So the church began in a church. So just like you see in nature, an apple seed produces an apple tree, you won't be surprised to see that a good church is produced by a good church. So one thing produces the other. In chapter 15, verse 40, there's a good church there, a fruitful church. The Lord is dealing with these men who are in the church and giving them a desire and a heart to go and do something. And it's checked out through the church. And eventually in verse 40, the church commends the men to go off and do the work. So the spirit is tested to see whether this really is the Lord. And when everybody's happy that it's of the Lord, they're sent out from the church. So from the church to plant churches. And you'll see that once these men have been set apart, as you go into chapter 16, verses 9 and 10, as these men are going out on this missionary endeavor to go and tell people about Jesus and do gospel work, the Holy Spirit is helping them on a sort of day-to-day basis and giving them direction, helping them make decisions. And you remember how in verses 9 and 10, there was this dream that they had in the middle of the night where they saw the man from Macedonia inviting them to come over to that area. And they realized that this was the Spirit, this was God speaking to them in their dream, helping them to further what the church had sent them out to do, to preach the gospel. And that's what we see in verse 10. They were clear at the end of the dream that Paul had, that they were going to Macedonia for the express purpose to preach the gospel, to extend the good news about Jesus to other people. So that's what it was. So here's some pretty good foundations for a church. It goes from the church to the church. It's not coming from outside. It's not out there from outer space. It's coming out from a fruitful church to go on and produce what is this fruitful church in Philippi, that the Spirit is working and giving leadership and direction. God is involved. He starts the thing. He remains involved in the thing, leading and guiding it. And that the thing that really qualifies the whole work they're doing is that it's focused very much on the gospel. It's gospel-centered. So all those things are very good foundations, aren't they? God's involved. The gospel's at the heart. The Spirit is bearing witness and helping and leading. Those are very important indicators. That's a very good foundation. And anything we should be doing, those sort of things would be there, that it's involved in the life of God's people, that the Spirit is encouraging and leading and directing, and the gospel is at the heart of what we're doing. Those are good foundations. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. But as we get into the passage we're looking at in verse 12, as they've been traveling around, they've gone through Asia, they're being led, there's some places they can't go, there's other places they can't go, they have the dream, they go over into Macedonia, there are various different towns that they visit and stop in, but they don't actually do any work in any of those places until we come to this place, Philippi. And what's stressed there in verse 12 is the strategic importance of the place. They were very clear, this was a Roman colony. Now, Roman colonies were not everywhere. This means that it wasn't just Greek, it wasn't just under Roman dominion. This is a Roman administrative center. This is where the bureaucrats, where the politicians, where the statespersons, where the state infrastructure is all based. This is a very strategic place. There's quite a lot of important people are going to be based in this city. And it's, as you read there in verse 12, it's a leading city. So if this city can be won, if the gospel can be established in Philippi, they can see that not only have they got good foundations, but they're going to put those good foundations down in a good location. And you've got to be wise, haven't you, when you invest your time. You can have good foundations, but if you go and put them in a silly place, out of the way, location, location, location. I think there's even a television program called that. Is that right? It's so important. It is so important. And the leading of the Lord is there. They've come to a place and they're recognizing that here is a good location for investing ourselves into something. So the Spirit is given. They've got good foundations to lay. And now they're putting those things down into a good location. They're being very wise, very strategic about how they use their time and how they use their efforts. But then as we press on, that's the second thing really, that was the second thing. The third thing here, as we press on, that when they come to the town, so here's a fantastic location, they've got good foundations, they've got a good basis for what they're doing, and they come to this place, and we get an insight into the state of religion, as it were, in that place. In verse 13. You can read it there for yourself. What do we find? We find there's a prayer meeting going on. It seems to be a women's prayer meeting taking place, and it's taking place outside the city walls. Now, I don't know if you believe this, but the Bible teaches us that God's eyes are looking through the earth, looking for people whose hearts are for him. And it's quite interesting that in the way they're led to this great strategic city, the way they're led takes them outside the city walls. Now, you do understand that when something says outside the city walls, in the culture, this is the language of exclusion. Right? You're going to this strategic city, you would imagine that you go to the high street, you go to the big buildings, you go to the temples, you go to the palaces that are inside the city walls. Anybody who's anybody has got a house and a place of worship inside the city walls. That's where culture approves what takes place. But they're taken outside the city walls, down by the river somewhere. Now that's just, in the olden days, outside the city walls, and you can still see this in the structure of London. You remember how Shakespeare's Globe was built outside the city walls on the south bank, and the gates would be shut at night, and everybody was outside the city. This is where the riffraff were. This is where the down and outs, where the slums were. This is where the people who didn't have permanent residency, where the traders were. And they're taken, instead of inside the city walls, they're taken outside the city walls to go and down to this place of prayer. And that's interesting too, a place of prayer. So there is some spiritual life, but this place of prayer does suggest that it is a religious meeting, obviously. But it's not in the ordinary sense where people make prayer in their temples, in their synagogues, their meeting houses, their fine buildings. Whatever prayer this meeting's taking place, it's in a very excluded and secluded place. It doesn't seem to be a sanctioned place of prayer. It doesn't seem to be an official place of prayer. And it must be a Jewish place of prayer, and I say that because in verse 13 it's stressed that they went out on the Sabbath. So clearly, whatever these women were doing outside the city walls, in this place of exclusion, outside of the ordinary infrastructure of religion, state religion as it were, approved religion, they were clearly Jews because the Sabbath, Saturday worship, was distinct to the Jewish people, and they found them worshipping on that day. So it seems pretty likely that whatever they were doing down there was involved in the Jewish religion in one way, shape, or form. Here were Jews, and the city was a Roman city where all the Roman religions were being practiced, and the Jews clearly did not have a stake or a place, a proper place of worship, there in the city. They're on the outside. They're on the outside, their religion's on the outside, they're physically on the outside, they don't even have a building over their heads. We read about Lydia, the woman Lydia, verse 14, that she was a worshipper of God, though. And that stresses to us once again the notion that this is a Jewish place of worship, because Lydia is a worshipper of God, and there's nowhere in the Bible that God is ever described as God except in the context of the one and only God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the rest are described as idols. So we can't believe for one minute that this woman is anything other than a worshipper of the same God that you worship today. So it's there on the Sabbath, so there they are worshipping. But this phrase, worshipper of God, is quite unusual. It's only used one other time in the whole New Testament, and that's in chapter 18, verse 17, when applied to a Gentile, a non-Jewish person, who for one reason or another has become attracted to the Jewish faith and become interested in the religion of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the teachings of Moses, and has become converted, if you will, to Judaism. So this woman Lydia, seems to be a non-Jewish person who's got involved in the Jewish faith, and that faith is in a very weak place, in a very weak state, as far as Philippi is concerned. Now, we don't know if there were any men present down there by the river in verse 13. We're not told that there were. And I think we should assume that there aren't, that this is just a group of women. And in terms of the Jewish religion, this is not of small significance. You know, if there's a proper place of prayer, you need 10 men to meet together to form it into a place of prayer. Anything less than 10 men and formal prayers can't be made. So the fact this is a group of women not only suggests that the state of their religion is in a very low and weak state, but the fact that they're even women, they haven't even got, they're not even part of the right gender grouping in order to have an official place, a proper place of prayer. This is a pathetic gathering, I suppose, what I'm trying to say, in the context of the situation. And it goes further than that. If I can be so blunt, in verse 13, they're down there by the river, and the purpose that Jewish women would go down by rivers is for the purpose of washing. And washing is to do with the ritual cleansings that are such a big part of Jewish religion. And most ritual cleansings are taking place in still water called a mikvah, and there are only one or two kinds of services that are performed for women in running water, like a river, in the Zav, which is the Hebrew word for running waters, the Zav, and that is when they themselves have had a flow, if I can speak in that euphemistic sense, and I'm sure you gather my meaning. After that, they would be then cleansed by the flowing waters of the rivers. So these women are not just women on the outside of a religion that's on the outside, but they themselves are ritually unclean and are excluded from even their place as women amongst Jews because of their own physical condition at that particular time, and that's why they're down there by the river. And verse 14, this woman Lydia is from Thyatira. She's not even a local. She's a foreigner. She's from a different culture. She's a Gentile. She's the wrong race. She's the wrong sex. They're in the wrong place. She's in the wrong physical state and condition to make prayer. She's a foreigner. And all I'm reading as I read these first voices is this language of exclusion. Here's this woman on the outside. She's on the periphery. She's excluded. She doesn't feel, she's not able to play a part or be a part. Not part of the city, not part of the synagogue, not part of the right religion, not part of the, she's not the right race, she's not the right sex, her physical body's not in the right physical condition. And what's so painful as you read about this woman in this state of exclusion, is that she's such a brilliant and capable woman. As you read in verse 14, by her activity, she's this dealer of purple. Have you any idea what a complicated, sophisticated business the dealing in purple is? This woman is like Mrs. Gucci. These are the luxury goods of the ancient world. Purple was so expensive, it was more expensive than gold. More precious than gold. And you know the wisdom and the majesty of God in this, the creation of purple. Do you know how you make purple robes? Have you any idea what it's made out of? Anybody here will know what it's made out of? It is too bizarre, it's too strange to be true, but it's true. First, to get the silks, she had to import silks from China. This woman was part of a kind of a trading relationship that went all the way to China. 2,000 years ago, she was trading with China, where these little tiny worms secrete out of their little tiny ends, this little tiny threads that are woven into silken bands that you can create these garments out of, these extraordinary lustrous garments. It's basically mucus coming out of a worm in China. And you combine that and weave that by the skill of material makers and manufacturing, and you weave them up into garments and create these beautiful lustrous garments. But the purple itself, you have to go down a particular part of the Lebanon coast. You have to dredge out into the shallows there, where there's a very particular kind of shell, the murex shells. And you need thousands and thousands and thousands of these shells and collect them all together. In fact, a German chemist in the year 2000 spent 2,000 euros producing 2 grams of purple dye according to the system and the mechanism that they used in those times. These shells had to be gathered in vast numbers. You had to scoop the snail out of the shell. And the mucus that separates the shell from the snail had to be separated and scooped out in tiny little portions and left out in the sun to die for a very specific amount of time. And in the light of the sun, this black mucus begins to change color until it becomes this glorious iridescent purple color. But if you leave it too long, it turns and goes brown, it spoils. You have to be so exact. And then you take this little cupful of this mucus and you mix it with these materials that come out of the back of a worm. And you dip the cloth in the dye, in the water that you mix into the water. And you bring it out, and these garments were worn by kings, worn by priests. These were garments to die for. And that was her business. You know, this is a smart lady. This is a sophisticated operator. This is a person who does international business in a highly complex manufacturing process. And she must have been earning for herself a small fortune. I mean, this really is the kind of like, you know, this is the luxury goods out, you know, of the ancient world. So she's right there on the exclusion, on the outside of society, and yet what she's capable of as an individual, she is such a capable individual. And you read in verse 15 a little bit later how capable she is. She has her own household. This is a woman in the first century running her own household. That means, yes, servants, slaves, running a big house. A household like that would probably have farms and all sorts of things. You know, this is a highly competent, highly capable, independent, mobile individual. And look, she describes it in verse 15. She says, why don't you come and stay at my house? This is at the time when men really had almost the entire monopoly on all power. But here is a woman who is holding her own at a very, very high level. Her clients must have been the upper echelons of society, and she was able to converse with them. And I always note in verse 15 there, and for those people who are involved in sales at all, you'll note in verse 15 that when she's talking to Paul, who is one of the most persuasive men in his generation, she prevailed over him to make him come and stay at the house. Do you read that in verse 15? She argued with him. She reasoned with him. She was able to persuade Paul. This is a persuasive, capable, worldly wise woman. What is she doing down there by the river? Why is she so far from the heart and the center of things? Why isn't she coming in from the outside, when she's so able? What is she doing there? And I can only see one reason why. Because of God. She's described as a worshiper of God. That all the opportunities, all her abilities, all the things, clearly something has come to mean more to her than all of that. Just that she might love God. And if that means becoming a person who has to worship outside the city walls, down by the river, unclean, with a weak, pathetic group of people, the Lord is doing something in her heart, giving her a hunger and a thirst to desire something more than life itself. And it's drawn her to the religion of the Jews who preach this message. I mean, I think we have this caricature of what the Jewish religion's all about, as if really what it was just lots of rules and cleansings and stuff like that. You know what's in this book? You know what's in the Old Testament? From the beginning, a message that the day is coming when God will send his Son. The message of the Messiah is contained in this scripture. This is a book containing a message of hope that one day the Redeemer will come, the Comforter, the ruler of the world, will send his Son as champion, as victor. And she was prepared to stake her all that when he came, she was in the right place at the right time with a right heart and a right attitude in preparation for the day of his coming. And if that meant putting herself out on a wild limb, it seems she was prepared to do it. The Lord had been preparing Lydia for a long time by the word and dealing with her spirit. So do you think, here's good foundations, and there are good foundations, as we said, but there's also, this is a great location, Philippi is a great location. But do you think there's a good justification for starting a church in Philippi? What is the real justification? Here's a woman who desperately needs to hear the good news about Jesus, isn't there? Now that is a good reason. That is a good reason to start the church. And what do? We read about it in verse 13. I love this. I love the fact. It says they sat down and they spoke to them. It's not just a casual conversation. They didn't stand there like strangers making small talk. They sat down. They established themselves down there on the beach by the river. They sat down and they spoke. And we can't be surprised at all about what they spoke about. They didn't just make small talk. Verse 14, Paul shared his message with them. That's what we read. And we have no doubts what that message could have been, because in verse 10 we're told that they went out with the express purpose in Macedonia to preach the gospel. That's his message. So they sat down there on the beach with these women, with Lydia, and they told them about Jesus, and they told them all about what he's done. Now, lots of people have theories about the book of Acts. I don't know what you think the book of Acts is all about. Some people say it's the Acts of the Spirit of God. But I can see, as I read through the book, that it's a book of sermons more than anything else. Chapter 2, verse 14, Peter stands to his feet. He preaches the gospel. Chapter 3, verse 11, he's standing on his feet again, Sanhedrin Council, preaching the gospel. Chapter 4, verse 8, again, following, preaching the gospel. Chapter 7, verse 1, Stephen, preaching the gospel. Chapter 10, verse 34, Peter, Paul this time, preaching the gospel. 13, verse 16, Paul, preaching the gospel. Sermon after sermon after sermon. And these are not little light things. They are involved. They open the scriptures. They open the Old Testament. They go thoroughly through. I cannot believe for one minute that as they sat down on the river, by that river with that lady in there with her friends, they did more, less than that. They opened up the Bible and they showed from the scripture that Jesus was indeed the Christ. That's what I believe they did. Makes me think of Jesus going down by the well. Did you mention it in your prayers about Jesus going down to the Sychar's well, the Samaritan woman down by the well, this excluded woman, this woman who comes out in the middle of the daytime to get her water because all the women won't associate her with her in the morning time when normally the women will come. And Jesus is found talking to this woman, people who other people would just avoid and were ashamed to talk to. But Jesus goes and talks to her. And it just does it. Do you remember how that conversation went? We have heard that the Christ is coming. You are speaking to am he. And that's the substance of this conversation down by the river, isn't it? That basically they are opening up the scriptures and showing this excluded woman down by the waterside that Jesus is Lord. I'm so full of wonder about these verses. Verse 15 as well. It says, the Lord opened her heart. The Lord started this thing. The Lord sent his word to this woman. He knew her. He'd heard her prayers. Her heart had been prepared. And then he opened her heart to receive the good news about Jesus. It's all of God. It's all of grace, isn't it? It's all of grace. No ultimate glory to man, all the glory is God's. And she responds in verse 15 with the simple act of baptism. Baptism. I don't know if any of you know where the word, the Greek word, that we get the word baptism from, comes from. Do you know the origin of the word, the Greek verb, baptismo? Do you know what it means? This is quite interesting. It's a technical term coming from the manufacturing industry of the ancient world. And the verb baptismo was a word used by dyers, people who were involved in dyeing, people who brought materials together and brought colours together and brought the materials and the colours together to the water, and then they dipped their materials down into the water and they received the fresh new colour, and out they came, glorified, transformed, changed, made beautiful, made acceptable, made ready to wear. I just think it's amazing that, you know, Lydia's whole life had been involved in baptismo. She had been baptizing. She'd been taking this mucus from Chinese worms and mucus from these, you know, Lebanon snails, and bringing these things together and taking these crude, rude materials and producing these beautiful things as a result. And now the Lord, it was seen, had been moving in his wisdom and might to take the crude materials of life and bring them together through his wisdom and plan, drawing all these things together, bringing to the point when she was dipped and came out totally changed. A whole new life. All her sins forgiven. Not excluded anymore. Now, dipped in purple, as it were, dipped in the crimson of Christ's blood, dipped in the water that washes us clean, readied, prepared, fit for a king, fit for Jesus, fit for God. All that hungering and that thirsting and all that preparation the Lord had been doing, been working in her life to bring her to that point where she would no doubt just step into the river and come out. I don't know, she came down there to be cleansed of something so small and passing, but she came out cleansed from something from which she should never be dirty ever, ever again. Never excluded ever again. A daughter of the Most High God. Beloved. Dressed in purple. Isn't that what we read about the robes of righteousness? We are priests. We are kings. We are a royal priesthood. And we come from such rude and rough beginnings, don't we? Taken of themselves, so ugly, so worthless, brought together in Christ's wisdom, so glorious, so beautiful. So they had good fruit for their labors, didn't they? Good fruit for their labors, led and directed by the Spirit. They are brought to exactly the right person, ready to receive the word of the Lord. Now, I'm looking at the time, so I'm going to try and skip through this last session here. There were men like Cornelius, was a God-fearer, wasn't he? He was another Gentile we read about in chapter 10, verse 1. A bit like her, a worshipper of God. And in the same way that we've just been reading, Peter this time was sent to him with the word that don't call what God has called clean, unclean. And we're seeing that all the way through the Bible, aren't we? In the New Testament, as the gospel is preached, people who are separate and unclean and separate from God are being called and made clean and baptized and washed. And Cornelius and the Samaritan woman and Lydia and all of them together, they bring their relatives together, they bring their friends together to come and hear the good news. And when the good news is being preached, as we read with Cornelius, chapter 10, verse 44, the Spirit falls on those who hear the word. And again we see the same pattern, people being baptized. In chapter 11, verse 14, Cornelius talks about how he expected the salvation of his whole household as a consequence of what was taking place. Now, we don't know what Cornelius or Lydia's household or the Philippian jailer's household was made up, but we do know that when they heard the word, they were able to speak in response to it. We know that they actually heard what they were hear, what was being said. Their hearts were opened. We know that they responded to the gospel. So we know these people are capable of responsibility. Each of them are capable of taking responsibility and answering for themselves. They're not just obeying the heads of their households. They're taking their little babies and baptizing them whether they've got a say in it or not. And I'm conscious, you know, as you listen to Francis I, the new Pope now, making his pronouncements, still, broadly speaking, around the world, it's being taught and preached by people like that, that a few incantations, possibly in the Latin tongue, and a priest holding a baby in a hand and a sprinkling of water is enough to make that child a regenerate and a Christian. That's not the foundations on which the Church of Jesus Christ is built up. The Church of Jesus Christ is built up on a personal response to Jesus Christ and his gospel. And that's what we see in the case of all these people. And not just a one-off response in baptism. In verse 15, just to conclude, in verse 15 we see that after all the various different things that had happened to Lydia, she then opens her home and it's so beautiful. She says, "Come and stay." This is not just something she just wants to experience once and then separate themselves. Being part of Christ's body is a permanent thing. Come and stay. She wants the gospel and Christians to be part of her life going forward for the rest of her life. And that's how the church was born. That's how it started. She opened her home to the Lord. And in verse 40, just very briefly, as they left, you'll notice as they left Philippi, other things happened. They went to Lydia's house before they left. And we notice there, and there they saw the brothers and they encouraged them and they departed. It wasn't just Lydia and her household. The brothers, God just was adding to the church. It was growing. It was growing. And that's what we'd expect, isn't it? We've got a growing church here as well already in those first few days. Good foundations, started from God, born of the Spirit, birthed out of the church into a strategic location, important place like Philippi. But finding a really good reason to do the work, somebody who really desired to respond to the gospel. What a better foundation is it than that? You build it around people and their responses we see in verse in the fourth point I was making, really, who react and respond to the word. God is prepared to respond to the word. Sometimes you see people get involved in Christian work and there's no response at all. There's no fruitfulness at all. You should ask yourself a question about that. Sometimes people want to go off into Christian work and there's no justification, no reason, there's no apparent need. You should ask yourself a question about that. Some people want to go and do something in some remote and strange places. Obviously, there doesn't seem to be any strategic value or purpose to it. You should ask yourself questions about that. Some people want to go off and do something. There's no real apparent foundation to it. It's not got the witness of the church. There doesn't seem to be much blessing from the Spirit. It doesn't seem to be much involved in the gospel. We should be asking ourselves questions about that. And also, this final point about the expansion of it, that once the thing's going, we should expect to see something grow. And if there's no growth, there's no fruitfulness, we should be asking questions about that. Because the things we're called to should be firmly fixed on God, his Spirit, his gospel, his plan, his strategy, meeting real needs, where that need is being valued and appreciated, and as a consequence of that appreciation, is growing too. Those are the things that I would say we should try and involve ourselves in and give ourselves to and be clear about ourselves as we're seeking to be servants of the living God. Well, we're going to close now and we're going to sing a finishing song and